2 Timothy chapter 2, we're picking up in our study at verse 26. 2 Timothy chapter 2, picking up at verse 26 in this particular context. Let's just pick up and read from verse 21. We'll be reading from the New King James Version for the sake of the context here. In 2 Timothy chapter 2, beginning our reading in verse 21, "Therefore, if anyone cleanses himself from the latter, he will be a vessel for honor, sanctified and useful for the master, prepared for every good work." This, of course, was in connection to Timothy, of course, separating himself from the false teachers that were mentioned in the immediate context. Then beginning in verse 22, he begins to give more personal remarks to Timothy. He says, "Flee also youthful lust, but pursue righteousness, faith, love, peace with those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart. But avoid foolish and ignorant disputes, knowing that they generate strife. And a servant of the Lord must not quarrel, but be gentle to all, able to teach, patient, in humility, correcting those who are in opposition, if God perhaps will grant them repentance, so that they may know the truth," or so that they may come to a better understanding of the truth, or so that they may acknowledge the truth. Verse 26 now, we pick up in our comments at this particular verse, "and that they may come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him to do his will." We ended here last Lord's Day morning in our study, and I wanted to take opportunity this morning to mention this. We mentioned that when we closed, that this phrase here, "come to their senses," literally in the Greek, is a phrase that means to become sober, to become sober again. And that is to wake up out of a drunken stupor. That's the way the Greeks use that particular phrase. The word itself, some of the Greek lexicographers believe that it refers to the practice of men sowing seed that had been laced or impregnated with some kind of drug, sowing seed for the birds. So when the birds would eat the seeds, they would fall asleep, and then they would cast a net over them and catch them. And we see that kind of in the picture of that verse that is being painted there. "And that they come to their senses," of course, those who are supposed to come to their senses or come out of this drunken stupor they're in, are those, of course, who stand in opposition to God, stand in opposition to the truth, those who have been mentioned in the immediate context, the false teachers, those who oppose the truth, oppose God, and that they come to their senses. Literally, the ideal again is become sober again and escape the snare of the devil. Snare of the devil, of course. Snare is a trap, but of course the devil doesn't literally throw a trap, and these under consideration aren't literally drunk. But the idea is that they've been taken captive by the snare of the devil. Snare here is a trap, but it's used metaphorically to refer to his tricks, his allurements, his schemes, his plans that he uses against us. Everything that he uses against us is a trap to ensnare us, to trick us. And so you might say he throws that net over us in his allurements, in the temptations that he throws our way. "And so that they may come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him to do his will." Having been taken captive by him. Taken captive here is a term that is used, of course, metaphorically. We're not literally taken captive by him, but he ensnares us. He entraps us with the allurements and temptations of sin. And the ideal of taken captive here is also expressed in Luke 5 and in verse 10 in reference to men being captured by the preaching or teaching of the gospel. Luke 5 and in verse 10, as Jesus told his disciples that he would make them fishers or catchers of men. And so they would catch, they would entrap, they would ensnare, but they would do that by or through the preaching or teaching of the word. And so does the devil trap, ensnare, but he does that by the temptations that he sends our way. through his schemes, his deceptions, his tricks, and so forth. Beginning in chapter 3, it seems as the subject changes, in a sense it does, but in a way it does not, because he continues to speak about false teachers. Let's just read down through verse 9, if we will, beginning at verse 1, because all of this is in the context. And he says, "But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come, for men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness, but denying its power, and from such people turn away. For of this sort are those who creep into households and make captives of gullible women, loaded down with sins, led away by various lusts, always learning and never able to come to a knowledge of the truth. Now as Jannes and Jambres resisted Moses, so do these also resist the truth. Men of corrupt minds disapproved concerning the faith, but they will progress no further, for their folly will be manifest all, as theirs also was." Brother Little, there's a sermon in this text, and a good title for it is False Teachers and Frail Women. False Teachers and Frail Women. Because he describes false teachers here, beginning in chapter 3 and in verse 1, and then he says, of this sort are those who creep into houses. And we'll talk about that frail or weak women, as it is translated in some versions when we get to that, literally little women. But here in chapter 3, beginning in verse 1, "But know this." This is something, of course, Timothy is to have a knowledge of. It's something that he was warned about in the first epistle as well. And we saw the same warning given in Peter's epistles. "Know this, that in the last days," perilous times will come, "in the last days." We studied that phrase when we studied in Paul's first epistle to Timothy. The last days. There's different ways we might understand that phrase, the last days. I guess the three primary ways that it is taken by men is that some believe that the last days has reference to the time period when Christ came until he comes again. So that's one way to look at the phrase, the last days. When Christ came, the last days began, and they will continue till Christ comes again. Another way to look at the phrase last days, and this is the way most of the premillennialists look at it, and those who are, we might say, doomsdayers look at it in regard to the book of Revelation. They look at the last days here as being the last days just immediate to the coming of Jesus Christ. The last days that just precede his coming. And that is, some say, we're living in the last days right now because we see the signs of the last days. And so that's the second way that is used in reference to this phrase, last days. Then a third way to consider the last days is the last days of the Jewish economy, the last days of what we might refer to as the Jewish dispensation or the Jewish kingdom as a people, as God's people. Of course, it's an Old Testament phrase, so in order to understand the phrase, the last days, we'd have to go back to the Old Testament and see, well, how is it used? In the Old Testament, last days is always used and spoken of something that is in the future. And it is almost always used with reference to the last days of God's people, the last days of the Jewish nation. And so I believe that thought is actually brought over into the New Testament. It's kind of amazing that the premillennialists and those who are doomsdayers in regard to the book of Revelation and the understanding of it never mention that the phrase is not even mentioned in the book of Revelation. But yet they say that's the last days. But it's never mentioned in the book of Revelation. I believe, out of the three ways that I just mentioned, that it is the last days of the Jewish nation that is under consideration. Perilous or grievous times will come. Now, if we understand it as being the time when the Lord came to the time that he is to come again, if that's the last days, we have to find some definition of that in the scripture somewhere. What I'm saying is, there ought to be something in the scripture that defines the last days for us as being when Christ came to the time he comes again. And the same thing is true in regard to the last days, that is the days just preceding the Lord's coming. We ought to be able to find a definition of that in the scriptures. As a matter of fact, I don't think we'll be able to find anything like that in the scriptures, because remember, when Jesus comes again, he's going to come as a thief in the night. And there are no signs given for Christ coming as a thief in the night. Now, in regard to destruction of Jerusalem, Matthew 24, Luke 21, Luke 23, and other places in the New Testament, there are signs regarding the coming judgment upon the city of Jerusalem by the Romans in 70 AD. But regarding the coming of the day of the Lord, there are no signs given in the New Testament. And that's why the premillennialists and others say, well, these are signs of the last times. This is things that are going to take place right before Christ comes. Well, what are those things? He's going to come as a thief in the night. A thief doesn't give you signs when he's coming. And the phrase, the last days, I believe refers to the time of the last days of the Jewish nation. When you go back and look in the Old Testament, the last days are always spoken of in the future. When you come to the New Testament, it's always spoken of as being present. Being present. I think we would all have to agree upon that. The last days are present when we come to the New Testament. They're always spoken of as being there already. Being in the lifetime to whom the New Testament was first written to. Remember, this epistle is not written to us first. To whom was it written to first? It was written to Timothy first. And he is living in the last time. Even though it says in chapter 3 and verse 1, but know this, that in the last days, it seems as though Paul is making prophecy, as though something is going to be in Timothy's future. But it's not in Timothy's future. It's in Timothy's presence already. Jump down to verse 5. Having a form of godliness, who? Well, those whom he just described from verse 2 and following, having a form of godliness but denying its power, and from such people turn away. Timothy could not turn away. He could not obey that command of God. He could not shun or avoid such people if this was going to be after the lifetime of Timothy. Not only that, the people who are described here are spoken of as being present already and creating the perilous times, the dangerous times, the difficult times, the grievous times, the distressing times, the hard times. They're spoken of as already being present because, note verse 6, for of this sort are those who creep into households. Creep in, present tense. And make captives of gullible women, loaded down with sins, led away by various lusts, always learning and never able to come to a knowledge of the truth. Present tense verbs speak of people already being present of this nature. So, of course, this speaks to us because people have not changed. But in Timothy's times, grievous and perilous and hard times were coming. Why were they coming? Well, because It had been long prophesied that grievous, and grievous or difficult or perilous times were coming, because Christ, as well as the other apostles, had spoken of it in Matthew chapter 24. Matthew 24 and in verse 21. Matthew 24 and in verse 21. For then there will be, note this, great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world till this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh will be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. We could read on, verse 23. Then if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there, do not believe it. For false Christ and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. I believe that's what Paul is warning Timothy about in our context. That's what's under consideration, the perilous and grievous times, the difficult and distressing and dangerous times of the Roman and Jewish wars, when these things are taking place. If not, then why would Paul even mention it to Timothy? If it was 100 years, if it was 60 years, if it was 2,000 years in Timothy's future, why even mention it to Timothy? It was mentioned to Timothy because there were people of this nature already present. This is simply the character of these false teachers, who creep in, come in, they worm their way into households. We saw the same thing when we studied in Titus and 1 Timothy. We read about the same thing. When we come to our study of the gospel of John's epistles, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, we're going to see the same thing. As a matter of fact, in the epistle of 1st John, people are told, don't even receive these people into your houses. Why? Because if you receive them into your houses, then you're going to fellowship their error. It's the same thing being warned by different apostles. By the Apostle Peter, 1 and 2 Peter we studied, people of this nature. 1 Timothy and Titus we studied people of this character, and here we see people of this character as well. They're all the same ones under consideration who are spreading false doctrine. The reason it's going to be dangerous or difficult times, grievous times, is because of the sin that these people engage in, the false doctrine that they proclaim, the teaching, because they lead people away from the truth. And so that's the time, I believe, that is under consideration. We have to keep it in the time frame in which it was written, and to the people, first and foremost, to whom it was written. It speaks to us. Of course, people's character has not changed, and the character of false teachers has not changed. And man has always, you probably could not read something that man has written to talk about the character of men. Man's character has always been like this since the time that sin entered into the world. And is it going to be hard and difficult and distressing and grievous at different times in history? Of course it will. And in their lifetime, it's hard for us to look back on it, because we didn't live their history. We didn't live that moment in time. But it was indeed very grievous, very difficult, very dangerous. Not only were the Christians caught up in the Roman and Jewish wars, but they were being persecuted by the unbelieving Jews as well. And so even the persecutions of the Apostle Paul and Timothy and others show us that it was grievous times, difficult times, dangerous times that they were living in because of the persecution that was upon them. We have no persecution like that today. Christians in some places around the world have such persecution, but not the kind even that they underwent in the first century. And even a couple of hundred years after that. But know this, he says, that in the last days perilous times will come, for men will be lovers of themselves. That is, they'll be selfish men, lovers of themselves. They'll just simply be selfish. They'll be concerned only about themselves. Self-centered. Love and concern for oneself. Now, I want you to try to keep this in the context of the time and think about the time that these people are living in and put it in the time period of the Roman and Jewish wars taking place. Remember, this is written in late 65 A.D. Do you remember what happens in 66 A.D.? Roman Jewish wars break out. Would that not be perilous times? Would that not be grievous times? Would that not be difficult times? It had to be. It had to be indeed. And so keep that in the context. And when you think about selfishness, when you think about in time of war, selfishness, well, people are concerned only about themselves. That's what's going to make it so grievous. They're not concerned about your health. They're not concerned about your welfare. They don't care whether you live or die. It is their life they're concerned about. Very selfish. That would indeed make it very grievous and very difficult time period. For men will be lovers themselves. Not only that, they'll be lovers of money. I believe the King James Version uses the word covetous, I believe. Yes. Covetous. But money and covetousness are not synonymous.
These first four verses, to me, comes close to describing America.
Well, it comes close to describing America because character of men has not changed since sin entered the world.
Amen.
It just hadn't changed. Why was the world destroyed by the flood? Because men were of this nature. Why was northern Israel taken into Assyrian captivity? Because they were of this nature. Why were Judah taken into captivity? Because they were of this nature. Why was Jerusalem destroyed in 70 AD? Because they had rejected the Christ. They were men of this nature. And so, it does. People are selfish today. They're lovers of money. They have a selfish greed for the accumulation of wealth. But we studied just on Wednesday night about the money changers in the temple and how it was that perhaps the priesthood were filling their pockets because they allowed them to come into the temple courts and sell animals for sacrifice and so forth. They had a greedy desire for wealth, as man has always had. But during this particular period of time, and if you would read some of Josephus in the Roman and Jewish wars and the destruction of Jerusalem, people would escape the city of Jerusalem and they would have swallowed gold coins and things like that in order to get away with, because of their greed for money, for wealth. And it does characterize people of every age, but during this particular period of time, it was grievous or distressing indeed. Then he describes them as boasters, one who is pretentiously proud and given to bragging about it, a braggart. And the braggart under consideration is one who is arrogant in regard to it, even though that word's going to be mentioned in the next word as proud. One is proud, he is arrogant, he is haughty. Those who are contemptuously look down on others and consider themselves better than others, either in social position or wealth or natural gifts, they're just proud and arrogant and haughty, believing themselves to be better than everyone else. Then he says blasphemers. And blasphemers are those who use abusive language, reviling and destroying with one's tongue, slandering and defaming others. Blasphemy can be done against man and against God. Of course, it describes people of every age, but during this particular period of time, just think about those who were blasphemous. It's condemned many times in the New Testament because people were engaging in it during this time. They were reviling and slandering one another and reviling and using abusive speech against God as well. Disobedient to parents. It simply refers to one who is refuses to be persuaded by his parents. In Deuteronomy 21, verse 18 and following, those in the Old Testament were subject to being stoned to death who were disobedient to parents. But think about in the first century during the Roman and Jewish wars, what did Jesus say was going to happen? Father and mother were going to turn against their children. The children are going to turn against their parents. Children have always been disobedient to the parents. And go all the way back to Genesis for that. But during this particular period of time, it would be indeed grievous, and that would make it even more so because children were disobedient to parents. Then the phrase unthankful is used, unthankful or ungrateful, directed toward those who are not thankful or they're ungrateful to both their fellow man and to God. Some people, regardless of what you do for them, they just don't seem to be grateful for what you do for them. They're just ungrateful. Many people have the attitude today that they're owed something. And when you help people, well, there's no thank you. There's no gratitude for what you've done for them because they feel like they're owed it. And so they shouldn't have to say thank you or be grateful for it. And that's the attitude of some even today. And then he uses the phrase unholy, that is, those who have no regard of duty for God, those who show no devotion to God, those who are impious, those who are wicked, those who are profane, those who are godless are the unholy. Then he mentions those who are unloving, without natural affection, the King James Version says, without natural affection. That word affection there in the Greek, and unloving, speaks of the kind of love that parents are to have for children and children are to have for parents. We see it, I use this illustration most often in regard to this world. When a mother will abort her unborn child, that's the word under consideration. That's unloving. That's unloving. And so what did Jesus say was going to happen in the first century? People would be unloving, yes. They would turn their parents over to the authorities. They would render them up to the authorities to be persecuted and put to death if they were Christians. They would certainly be unloving. And then he describes them as unforgiving or truce breakers, the King James Version says. The idea in this Greek word is one is completely irreconcilable. You want to make peace with them, but they're unwilling to make peace. They're unwilling to be appeased. I see that in some of the people who are creating anarchy today in our streets, the rioters and looters. Regardless of what you do, they will not be appeased. That's the one under consideration here. Unwilling to forgive. Truce breakers, King James Version says. Unforgiving is the better translation of it. They simply, regardless of what you do, and you may know of some people in your own life, regardless of what you do, they're unwilling to make peace with you. They're unwilling to be appeased, regardless of what kind of things you do to reach out to bring about unity and peace between the two of you. Then he uses the word slanderers now, and this is a little different from the word blasphemers. Blasphemers are slanderers and defamers, those who revile and those who use abusive speech toward God and toward man. But the slanderers here, better translation is the King James Version, false accusers. False accusers, like Satan is a false accuser. Who is a false accuser? Well, a false accuser is one who divides, one who accuses someone of wrong for the purpose of dividing them against someone else. You might work in a workplace where there's someone, we might say, is always stirring the pot, always dividing one employee against another, or dividing the employees against the owners of the company or whatever. That's who's under consideration here. False accusers. That's what Satan does. He seeks to separate you from God. He seeks to falsely accuse you, as he falsely accused Job. Without self-control, of course, this, like all the other words, describe people of our own time. Without self-control, without self-restraint. No doubt the idea in the context is without self-restraint, people just, they live hedonistic lives. They live hedonistic lives. They have no self-control, no self-restraint. Their greatest goal in life is to seek all the pleasure they can. So, without self-restraint, without self-control, incontinent, the King James Version says. Of course, we know that in the English language has reference to not being able to control ourselves. And brutal is the next word. Fierce, the King James Version renders the word. One who is brutal is one who is savage. He's savage like a beast, savage like an untamed animal, wild, vicious. Now, that describes people today, but it would certainly describe people in the first century as well, especially during this particular time period that is under consideration. Then he describes them as despisers of good, those who despise good. Despisers of those that are good, the King James Version says. The idea is they simply do not love what is good. They hate the good. And they have a lack of love for anything that's virtuous, anything that is upright, anything that would be considered moral. So they have a greater affection, you might say, for that which is evil and that which is wicked than that which is virtuous and upright. So they're despisers of good. Everything that is good, they despise and they show contempt for it. Then he refers to them as traitors, as traitors. Someone name me a traitor in the New Testament. Judas. He was the traitor. He betrayed the Lord. What do you think would happen in the first century when unbelieving Jews from the Sanhedrin Council are sent to your door and knock on your door and they're looking for Christians? Like Paul, if he came to your home, Saul of Tarsus came to your home looking to drag Christians back to be persecuted in the city of Jerusalem. Would you give up? Would you betray a fellow Christian? No doubt there were a lot of betrayers in the first century who betrayed their fellow Christians. It was a grievous time, a difficult time. You know, you had to look out for yourself, but because of the selfish nature and the brutal nature of others, they would give you up in a heartbeat to save their life. And that's the traitors under consideration. They breach the trust of their fellow man. They breach the trust of the fellow Christians. Then headstrong, he describes them as, or heady, the King James Version says. One who is headstrong is one who is rash, one who is reckless. They just head as fast as they can and headlong into perhaps matters that they don't know the outcome to. Perhaps in the pursuit of a bad end, under the influence, no doubt, of the desires or passions that they have. They're rash, careless, reckless. Lovers of pleasure. It describes the hedonist of our time as well. Those who have a desire for pleasure instead of a love for God. Lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. That is, they have a greater affection for pleasure and the things that bring pleasure in this life than they do have an affection for God. We see that so much in the absence of so many people, even in the church. People who seek pleasure instead of seeking to be pleasers of God. They have a greater affection for pleasure. They are hedonistic. Hedonism, the doctrine that pleasure or happiness is the sole or chief good of life.
Nowadays, people are not happy unless they're being entertained. They will constantly be entertained.
Seekers of pleasure. Happiness and pleasure, that's their chief aim and purpose in life, they think. All right, well, we didn't get very far, but hopefully we understand that particular text a little better. Having a form of godliness. Having a form of godliness. That is, they have a pretense of godliness. Godliness is reverence, respect, piety toward God. They simply have a form of it. What's he saying? They're hypocrites. They're hypocrites. Jesus described the people of his day over and over again, especially the religious leaders, as hypocrites. Because these people are religious. And we'll see that in the following text. They're religious people. That's who is being described here. False teachers. But they're religious, but they only have a form or pretense of godliness. Right. We wouldn't think of these people as being religious, would we? But these people are religious. They're false teachers. They are religious people. And that's why they're leading people astray. We're out of time, so we'll pick up here at verse 5 next Lord's Day morning. Thank you very much for your kind attention and your good comments.